You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is Little Rock-based writer Kevin Brockmeyer, the author of The Brief History of the Dead, The Illumination, and A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, and a frequent guest here on Studio Tulsa. His latest project is a foray into flash fiction, very short stories written on a single page of manuscript. The 100 stories that make up his new book, The Ghost Variations, are in fact all ghost stories. But virtually none are the campfire or gothic version of a traditional ghost story. A few are chilling, but more often they're humorous or poignant. In the first story, an apparition in a law office is what workers look for when they're bored at work. In another, a medium can't get away from her dead mother who accompanies her everywhere. In still another, a dead relative offers a relation in earnest prayer a feeling of relief and discovers he's now on call 24/7 for prayer requests from the person. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Kevin Brockmeyer, it's always a pleasure to have you back with some of your inventive writing, and certainly The Ghost Variations is indeed that. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely, Rich. Thank you for inviting me.
Would you start by reading one of the 100 stories that make up The Ghost Variations?
Of course. So this is story number 6 in the book. The title is A Long Chain of Yesterdays. Not for the first time, or even the 100th, the bank president stands at his office window at 6:03 on the evening of Tuesday, March the 3rd, 1987. Two birds square off on the other side of the glass, bickering over what looks like a raisin. The sky is as pink as cupcake frosting. Far below him, a delivery truck triggers its horn, an agitated sound that the distance transforms into an adorable beep. The scene is so calming, so toy-like, that originally, for one bare minute, smack in the middle of his life, it suffused the bank president with a sense of inexplicable peace, a bone-deep certainty that everything would be all right. But after the 8th repetition, or the 19th, he noticed that at this time of day, on this date, the horn always beeps adorably. The birds always nip at the raisin. The sky is always a cupcake pink. Thus, the bank president feels overcome, despite the beauty and charm of it all, by the tedium, the invariability. He knows that his ennui is not March the 3rd, 1987, at 6:03's fault. Not specifically. Every other moment is just as static. Take 11:24 on the morning of Friday, July 26th, 1940. It is his older sister's 8th birthday. He is drinking lemonade in the backyard. His elbows are reddening against the picnic table, and a coiled paper party horn is crimping to the left as he blows through it. Or 4:36 a.m. on Wednesday, December 6th, 1972. He is watching the color bars on a hotel TV and crunching the ice from a gin and tonic. Idly, he plucks at the hangnail on his thumb, then strips it loose with his front teeth. The cold of the ice on his lips deadens the sting. Or 3 in the afternoon on Thursday, August 10th, 2006. He is trekking through the rough after a golf ball when his heart makes a fist around itself. Then he is lying on his back beneath a catalpa tree with a V-shaped trunk. The leaves vary their patterns of lighter and darker green as the wind bats them around in the sunlight. He remembers his pleasure upon discovering, after his heart stopped, that as a ghost he could revisit any moment of his life, as many times as he wanted to. Any minute, though, no matter how extraordinary, will harden into its form if it happens the same way often enough, he soon discovered. Eventually, the bank president worries, he will forget that he is a ghost, that this endless series of repetitions is not his life. We'll forget how it felt when things could still happen for the first time. For now, though, he stands once more at his office window. It is 6:03 on the evening of Tuesday, March the 3rd, 1987. Despite the pinkness of the sky, the The streetlights have already been kindled. Long rows of dots that, for reasons he does not understand, seem to grow brighter the farther away they are.
That's a very nice story. And it's like many of the stories in this collection that they start out one way and then they flip in the course of one or two pages. And that's what all of these stories are. They're very, very short stories, 100 of them altogether, on ghosts and elements surrounding ghosts. Was this an exercise, a personal challenge? What was the origin of all these stories?
Well, I guess it's fair to say that it became a personal challenge. As a reader, I found myself more and more attracted to the very short form, flash fiction. And I wanted to try my hand at it. So the inspiration for the book was simply to write a sequence of 100 one-page stories. Very soon after that, I decided that ghosts would make a good organizing theme for the book. As I thought about it, I found it an inspiration to my imagination. And I thought that I could simply come up with 100 conceits that might fill a book of 100 one-page ghost stories.
Was it as easy as it first seemed to sound in your head?
Alas, no. Every book I write, I think, I'm finally taking it easy on myself. This one will be a breeze. And it turned out to be unusually difficult for me. All of the stories are very short. That said, each one required me to come up with a beginning, an end, and the briefest of middles. And each one required me to come up with a conceit that seemed to me to vary from the conceits of all the others. And, although it was a form that I loved as a reader, it wasn't the kind of fiction I had ever tried to write before. So I found myself challenged by the form and figuring out what to do with it and how to create stories of this type.
Now, as I understand it, it was one-page manuscript. That was sort of the rules of the exercise, if you will.
That's right. Yeah. Specifically in my word processing system, I think it was no longer than a single manuscript page and no less than two-thirds of one.
How did that hone your own sense of writing? Do you think it's honed it in a way that will be useful for you down the road?
Useful, that's a question that remains to be seen. I hope that I'm going to complete a novel next. The form in which I've been working is a form of condensation. So I might have to abandon some of the skills I learned for that form in order to complete the novel. But it did educate me toward the form. And I found by the time I was finished writing the book that many of the stories I was reading simply seemed way, way, way too long. like attenuations of stories rather than stories that were following their natural length requirements.
Interesting. That's a keen insight that a lot of people have when they're reading short stories. It's like, you think of a short story as being a condensation of a longer fictional form, but in fact, sometimes there's padding and stretching.
That's true, yes. Ideally not in any short story, but certainly not in a story that's only going to be a single page long.
Now, why ghost as the organizing element?
I simply found them fascinating. I have no particular, the book has been in print for exactly one day now, but already I've been asked several times whether I've had an encounter with a ghost, and I never have. But I find the idea intriguing. I wrote an earlier book called The Brief History of the Dead that was set partially in the afterlife. I've written at least one longer short story called Father John Melby and the Ghost of Amy Elizabeth that was a ghost story. And I remember, so I'm interested, first of all, as kind of the afterlife as a place in which to conduct a kind of speculative play. I just find that kind of thinking invigorating. And I thought I could apply it, with luck, 100 times to the stories in this book. But I'm also thinking now, and this hadn't occurred to me until just now, but I've written a couple books for children as well, middle grade books. Mm-hmm. And it's been some time since I wrote them, but I would give readings at elementary schools. And you tend to get some unusual questions from children that you don't get from adults. And you often get the same questions over and over again. One of the questions I always got when I visited an elementary school was whether I had ever written a ghost story. And I think maybe somewhere in the back of my head, you know, I was disappointed in myself that I always had to let these kids down by telling them, no, I haven't. And now I can tell them, yes, I've written 100 of them. And when you're a little older, maybe you'll enjoy them.
Well, it's interesting because most of these are not what you would describe as the traditional description of a ghost story, though. I think very few of them. One of the most interesting is the very last one in the collection, which describes the most harrowing ghost story ever written.
Yes.
But it never tells us the ghost story.
It does not. It tells us the titles under which it's been translated. So you can kind of see glancingly what the story might be about. This is maybe the most Borgesian story in the book. again, and he's a writer I adore. It's called The Most Terrifying Ghost Story Ever Written. And one of the things that turns out to be so terrifying about it is that everybody who attempts to translate it into English, although they endow the story with a new title each time, they all find that for whatever reason, the English translation is identical to each translation that came before, which suggests that there might be some kind of horrifying mystical impulse that just exists inside the text of the story itself.
Yes, but the actual piece is written as this very dry academic
That's right, yes.
description.
It's sort of a report about this book rather than the tale that the book contains.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about what you do with this book is you have 11 different thematic sections, and then there's this very, you know, 3 to 4 times the length of the stories, concordance at the end that further sort of sets all of these stories into various thematic elements, but, you know, all sorts of descriptions. Why was that important to do?
Well, you asked me earlier if the book was an exercise. I would say that that concordance of themes was an exercise. And I'm very pleased with it. Like it seemed to me when I did not write that concordance until the entire book was finished. But when I did, it revealed all sorts of things to me about what my own obsessions happened to be that I wasn't aware of when I was writing these stories. So what happened is that my editor purchased the collection, and his feeling, and at the time, the collection was simply an unbroken sequence of 100 numbered stories without titles. He recommended that I title all the stories and that we find some other additional organizing principle for the collection, which would just make it a more welcoming prospect for a reader. So he asked me if I could think about ways to organize this material. And over the course of a weekend, I came up with this long list of themes, categorized each of the stories into its multiple themes, and shared it with him. And we both felt it added something to the material of the book, so we kept it as a concordance.
What's also interesting is there appears to be, for some of the conversations you've already had about this book, that there's a little bit of personal significance in the titling and numbering of some of these stories. For example, number 7 is a lucky story, number 13 is an unlucky story.
Yes.
And both of them are hilarious. And that's the other thing about a lot of these ghost stories. Some are touching, some are sad, some are a little scary, but others are very hilarious. The Hitchhiker and Mira Ambler are both very funny stories. Tell us about those two.
Okay. Well, let me talk about Mira Ambler first. So there are very few stories in the book that contain proper names for their characters. But two of them do. One is called Milo Crane. One is called Mira Ambler. A couple of my closest friends have children named Mira and Milo. And I wrote the Milo Crane story. That's his actual name. And afterwards, Mira, their daughter, felt disappointed that she didn't have her own story in the book. So I wrote a story with, I didn't feel that I could give her the same last name as the Milo character. So I gave her her mother's last name, Mira Ambler. And that is a story about a woman who believes herself to be asleep and sort of awakens to find herself in an auditorium where awards are being handed out to people who have recently died are currently dying or will soon be dying. And she, it turns out, is the runaway favorite for many of these awards. Although she had not yet died, she learns that she will be dying soon, and that the way in which she will be dying seems hilarious to this body of awards givers. So she finds, I think, the experience rather discomforting. but as a reader, I hope you'll find it amusing. Another of the stories, The Hitchhiker, is spun out of an old Rod Serling Twilight Zone episode, which has that same title. And this is a famous episode of the series, and it's about a woman who's driving across the country. And she keeps encountering a man on the side of the road who seems horrifying to her. And he's a hitchhiker, and he keeps asking her, "Are you going my way?" And in the Twilight Zone episode, she does not realize until very late that she has died, and this figure is escorting her into the afterlife. And the hitchhiker, this character, realizes very early that she has died, and that's what's happening.
And they want to send her to Toledo.
To Toledo. He keeps asking her if she's going to Toledo, and she realizes that if she keeps refusing to understand what's happening to her and insisting that she has no intention of going to Toledo, then she can basically just remain alive forever. That she never has to move on into the afterlife. So that's what she chooses to do. She out-clevers the ghost or the Grim Reaper.
My guest today is Kevin Brockmeyer. He's the author of novels and story collections, including The Brief History of the Dead, The Illumination, the memoir A Few Seconds of Radiant Film Strip, and his latest book is titled The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Since you've already written one book that really focuses on death, The Brief History of the Dead, in which the premise is that when you die, you go to this place called the city where you remain until all memory of you cease to exist. Was there any, did you appropriate any of that for a story that ended up in this collection?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure that I did. However, I definitely appropriated material from my two prior story collections. Mm-hmm. Things That Fall from the Sky and The View from the Seventh Layer. So if you're writing a sequence of 100 ghost stories, there are times when you're struggling for inspiration. And what I did was take the titles of all the stories from those earlier books of mine, pen them to the top of a long sequence of these ghost stories with blank pages, and just use those titles as inspiration points for one story or another, for 24 stories, as it happens. You know, and some of them were directly related to the material in those earlier books, and some of them just used the titles to inspire kind of new pathways into the idea of a ghost story.
Now, I was thinking about story number 66, which is about the devil.
Oh, okay.
And which was interesting because it uses this idea of the devil has purchased so many souls that they're worthless to him.
Yes.
They're like pennies.
Yes.
And he finally decides, he basically gets out of the soul.
Out of the soul business. He begins spending all of these souls and buying, like, worthless knickknacks with them, basically.
Yeah, tell us about this story.
All right. I'm pleased that you asked me about this one. Every so often, I and other writers get the question, do you ever wake up having dreamed a story? And I don't, basically. And the reason for that is that stories unfold for me in the writing as a long sequence of sentences. And it's difficult to dream a long sequence of sentences. This story is the exception. I can't say that I dreamed, like, every twist and turn of every sentence in the piece. But I did, in fact, dream the material, and I knew when I woke up what the opening few sentences and what the closing few sentences of this page-long story would be. I don't know exactly where that came from, but somewhere deep in my unconscious mind, the story just kind of erupted. This is one of the stories that did seem wedded to its number. It's about the devil, so it had to be number 66. There are a couple other stories in the book. Number 33, which is the age at which Jesus died, had to be the Jesus story. And if 33 is Jesus and 66 is the devil, 99 needed to be God. So those stories were wedded to their numbers.
And we see a little of your own personal theology or lack of theology show up in these three stories.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if the afterlife feels to me like a playground for the imagination, theology feels like the same thing to me. I mean, I can't say that I'm deeply read in theology, but I do find it interesting. I did take some religious studies courses when I was in college and graduate school. And there are some writers who are at least theology adjacent, like G.K. Chesterton and Simone Weil, and some fiction writers like Graham Greene and, you know, C.S. Lewis, or Philip Pullman as the sort of atheistic side to that coin, who invest their works with thinking about religion and specifically about Christianity. So, I mean, I was raised in the Christian tradition, and those stories continue to be influential to me as just ways of processing the world and imagining my way through my life.
I have to ask you about a couple of the stories which really I thought were just very touching. One was Bouquet, number 54. You know, anybody who's experienced loss knows that when you have that loss, for a while, it's almost like you can still smell that person on the pillows. You can smell them in the closets. And it's a beautiful story of how the ghost returns in the form of aroma.
Yes. You know, it's uncanny, the stories you're picking out to discuss with me. My mom just read the book within the past few days. That is her favorite story in the collection. So, I mean, I'll be giving a reading in Little Rock, my hometown, sometime soon. She asked me to read that story at that event when I do. And, yeah, that's the conceit. There's a woman who has lost her husband, and she always knew that when he was gone, she would miss the sight of him and the sound of him. But it had never occurred to her that she would miss the scent of him. And she begins smelling him everywhere, realizes that he's trying in this way to communicate with her from beyond the grave, and tries to find a way of communicating back.
There's another one that uses communication in an unusual way, but it's a very funny little story. But it's also sort of poignant in its own way, and that's Dusk and Other Stories. Mm-hmm. That's number 96. And this is really wonderful because it's an elegant poltergeist who has found that he can no longer communicate other than through telekinesis.
Yes.
And he finds a way to communicate with the person inhabiting his space.
That's right, yes. And the person who is inhabiting his space is a bibliophile with bookcase after bookcase of titles. And the poltergeist begins communicating by way of these titles, exhibiting certain books to his sight as a way of asking him questions and answering the questions he might have. And they develop a relationship, they converse. All of the book titles I use in that story are the titles of actual books that are on my own cases. So when I was writing the story, I just walked my shelves to see what questions and answers might arise.
There was the other poignant story I was going to mention that I found very striking. It's called A Life. It was number 85. And it's the story of a woman who she has just died. And she sees her family in her house.
Yeah.
Her husband is drinking. It's mid-morning. The son is going to the bathroom with the door open. The younger child is outside throwing a ball against either the house or some wall. Then she realizes she can hear the thoughts of her family.
Yeah.
And this is where it all of a sudden flips. Tell me a little about this story.
What she realizes is that she was a source of exasperation for her family and that they didn't really love her. This tears her apart. Some of the stories in the book, it's easy for me to remember what it was that inspired them. And this is one of those, the last few lines of that story. Mm. She had always been so confident that she would be missed one day, so certain she was loved. If nothing else, she thought, her life had been a learning experience. But she hadn't wanted a learning experience. She had wanted a life. And, you know, I mean, this was a thought I had to myself on a dark day, I guess. You know, I thought, well, you know, I had been exposed to certain forms of suffering, and I guess they had been a learning experience. But no, like, that's not what I was asking for, by God. I wanted a life.
Yeah, those last few lines are just grab at you. It was wonderfully written.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, you know, you've written the brief history of the dead. You spent so much time on these ghost stories. So you've written about death and the supernatural. The Illumination is sort of a supernatural story where all of a sudden you can see person's pains, whether they're emotional pains, their physical scars, their old injuries, they illuminate with light. So I have to ask you, do you believe in ghosts or a spiritual plane of some sort?
Well, I would love to. I certainly believe in ghosts and in a spiritual plane as an inducement to the imagination. Just what I find is that, you know, I am a small C Catholic reader, but as a writer, my work tends to take on a life when it has some element of fantasy to it. I wrote a memoir about my seventh grade year of school, and even that has got an odd middle chapter that's plainly speculative and couldn't conceivably have happened in the real world as we understand it. And that's basically a way of inspiring me to invest myself in the material. I mentioned Chesterton earlier, and he has a quotation that I've always thought is appropriate to kind of the distinction between the fantastic and the realistic. And he's writing in a book called The Poet and the Lunatics about St. Peter, who is reported to have been crucified upside down so as not to duplicate the sacrifice of Jesus. And he says he has a character say in this book that at that moment when Peter was dying upside down, he was vouchsafed a vision of the world as it really is, with the stars like flowers and the clouds like hills and all men hanging on the mercy of God. And when I read that, it seemed to me that it said something profound about what it is that the fantastic can do to the readerly or writerly imagination. It allows you to see things at a tilt, and yet somehow you see them more sharply and they're better illuminated than they were before when you were seeing them in their upright fashion.
The name of the collection is The Ghost Variations, which it's a wonderful collection. You can read 5 or 6 of these at a time, and they all have a very different take on the old campfire staple, the ghost story, The Ghost Variations. Kevin, thanks very much for joining us.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. Thank you for talking with me.
Novelist and fiction writer Kevin Brockmeyer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest project is titled The Ghost Variations, 100 Stories. It's published by Pantheon Books. His other books include The Brief History of the Dead and The Illumination. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.